The Khatra Foundation presents the Khatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Khatra AI. Okay, so today we're diving into a really remarkable and recently rediscovered work, Cold Crematorium, reporting from the land of Auschwitz. It's by Josef Debreczyny. He was a Hungarian Jewish journalist and editor, lived from 1905 to 1978. Now, he actually wrote this book way back in 1950.
That's right.
But it's only just received its English translation in 2024. And people are calling it a masterpiece that was basically hidden in plain sight. So we want to unpack why this particular account is so significant today.
Well, I think the key thing is its perspective. This isn't a story focused on, say, spiritual redemption or even heroic resistance in the way some memoirs are. Debreczyny was a secular humanist, you know, a man of reason.
A journalist.
A journalist, exactly. And he approached Auschwitz almost like an assignment. His mission, as he saw it, was to report, to analyze.
So it's the tone, that clinical observation.
Yes, that's precisely it. It's an unflinching, almost cold, analytical gaze. He survived in part by becoming a kind of scientist, observing a disease, documenting its progression. That's its unique power, I think.
And he came from this background, respected editor in Vojvodina, Novi Sada before the war, a man of words, whose entire world was about to be systematically, well, destroyed. So let's trace that journey, that descent. It really starts with the mass deportations of Hungarian Jews in 1944, doesn't it?
It does. That's the rupture. The cattle cars, the horrific journey itself, that's the transition. But the real foundational trauma hits the moment they arrive at Auschwitz-Birkenau.
The selection.
Yes, the infamous selection on the ramp, Dr. Mengele. Chaos. And in those few seconds, Debreczyny is waived right temporary labor. His wife, Lenka, she's sent left.
To the gas chamber.
Immediately. In that instant, his identity, husband, editor, intellectual, it's all severed. He becomes a number. Just gone.
Yeah.
It's the annihilation of the self, even before the real physical suffering ramps up.
And that suffering, that systematic process, brings us to the core concept of the book, this chilling phrase, the cold crematorium. What did he mean by that? It's a really arresting term.
It is. And his distinction is crucial and horrifying. He labels the gas chambers, the furnaces, the places of instant mass murder. He calls that the hot crematorium. Mm. Efficient, quick destruction.
Okay.
But, he argues, the vast majority who survived the initial selection, who were sent to the satellite labor camps like Dernau or Liberos, they entered what he called the cold crematorium.
So not immediate death, but...
But slow, industrial, anonymous death by attrition. It wasn't about gas or bullets. Primarily. It was about the system itself.
A system designed for death.
Absolutely designed. It was meticulously calibrated starvation. The calorie counts were scientifically calculated to ensure that nobody could survive beyond a few months. It was rampant disease, typhus, dysentery deliberately left untreated. Mm. It was exhaustion from brutal forced labor, plus exposure to the Polish winters. Death wasn't an accident. It was the intended output of the factory. The prisoners were just raw material being consumed.
That reframing is powerful. It forces you to see it not as just random cruelty, but as a rationalized bureaucratic engine of death.
Exactly.
A factory. So how does a man like Debreczyny, grounded in reason and secular humanism, even process that? What happens to your philosophy when faced with such systematic inhumanity?
Well, his pre-war beliefs were basically incinerated on the arrival ramp. What emerged in their place was something he termed a grim biological materialism.
Meaning?
Meaning he observed that the camp environment strips human beings down to their most basic biological functions. You become an organism driven by one overwhelming force, need, primal need.
And that led him to formulate this law of the stomach.
Precisely. He realized that in the camp, this one law overrides everything else. Morality, ethics, social bonds, reason itself, they all become secondary or even irrelevant compared to the simple, desperate need for calories.
He actually wrote that the brain became like a useless appendage, didn't he? Switched off to keep the stomach running.
Yes, the sole organ of self-preservation, running at full capacity. It's a stark, brutal assessment of how survival worked at its most fundamental level. It boiled down to caloric arithmetic.
And you see that in the small details he records, like the anecdote about the organized potato. Can you share that? It really illustrates the point.
Oh, it does. It's incredibly telling. Organizing, of course, was camp slang for sealing, acquiring. Getting hold of a single raw potato was a major coup, often a collective effort, and incredibly risky.
Right.
But the ritual around dividing it, that's what's striking. They wouldn't just wolf it down. They'd gather in secret. and the division was treated with immense gravity, like a sacred ceremony.
Dividing it into wafer-thin slices, he says.
Exactly. Wafer-thin. Each person would receive their tiny slice and consume it with absolute concentration. Slowly. Deliberately. Trying to extract every possible sensation, every microcalorie.
So all thought, all focus, is reduced to that single potato slice.
It demonstrates how hunger completely hijacked consciousness. Everything became about feeding the stomach, just surviving until the next meager ration the next minute.
So there's this overpowering biological drive, the law of the stomach, to stay alive. But you mentioned earlier there was another part of him operating, something connected to his old self.
Yes, okay. And this is maybe the key to his specific survival. Alongside the biological imperative, there was an intellectual one, the drive to observe and record.
The journalist resurfacing.
In a way, yes. The journalist inside never completely died. He started mentally documenting everything, the absurd rules, the casual cruelty, the bureaucratic details, the suffering.
Transforming it into data.
Sort of, yes. Turning raw experience into observations. This act of analytical detachment, it created a kind of mental distance, a shield. It preserved a tiny fragment of his former self, the writer.
So the reporting instinct became a survival mechanism itself.
It absolutely did. It gave him a purpose beyond just enduring. If he lived, he knew he had this absolute duty to report what he saw with that clinical precision we talked about.
And that commitment to reporting the truth meant he couldn't look away from the most difficult aspects, including the moral compromises within the prisoner population itself. This brings us to that concept. Primo Levi also explored the gray zone. How does Debert Sani depict that?
This is really central to the book's importance, and maybe its controversy. He realized the Nazi system was diabolical, not just because it killed, but because it was engineered to corrupt. To blur the lines.
Making simple good versus evil impossible.
Utterly impossible. He focuses intensely on the prisoner hierarchy. The kapos, the block elders, the foremen. These were prisoners, victims themselves. Yet they often wielded power more brutally and arbitrarily than the SS guards.
They were often feared more directly.
Very often. The system deliberately forced the oppressed to participate in oppressing each other. It fostered incredible distrust and made organized resistance almost unthinkable. Debert Sani is unflinchingly honest about this moral murkiness.
Did his own path to survival force him into similar ambiguities? You mentioned turning points for him personally.
Oh, absolutely. There were several critical moments. First, there was his own physical decline. He describes hitting rock bottom, being dismissed by a prisoner doctor as a musselman, basically, a goner. Someone who'd given up the will to live.
Wow.
Pulling back from that brink required a conscious, painful re-engagement of that analytical mind, fighting off the apathy. That was one turning point, deciding not to become a musulman.
And the second key one?
The second, and perhaps the most decisive for his long-term survival, was becoming a schreiber, a scribe, a clerk in the camp office.
Because he was literate?
Because he was literate, yes. His past life literally saved his current one. This indoor job protected him from the worst of the physical labor and the elements. But it also placed him right inside the camp's administrative machinery.
Squarely in the gray zone, he was observing.
Exactly. He was now part of the system, albeit at a low level. This gave him unparalleled, though horrifying, access. He could see the paperwork, the lists, the bureaucracy of death from the inside. He gathered the data for this report firsthand.
So to maintain that role, to observe and record while being part of it, what was the emotional cost? He must have had to build some serious walls.
Complete walls. Emotional suppression was his core strategy. He writes very clearly that nerves were a private luxury, a life-threatening one.
A luxury you couldn't afford.
Precisely. To allow himself to feel the rage, the grief for his wife, the constant fear that would consume precious energy, make him vulnerable, tip him towards becoming a musulman. So he consciously maintained intellectual detachment. It was armor.
It's just staggering to think he then sat down and wrote this incredibly detailed clinical account so quickly after the war in 1950. The need to bear witness must have been overwhelming.
It clearly was. And it's why his legacy, now that the book is finally getting attention, is so significant. He really belongs alongside figures like Primo Levi, the great analyst survivors.
Forging a new language for it all.
Yes, a language that had to be precise, clinical, almost scientific, to convey the scale and nature of the horror without resorting to melodrama, using metaphors from industry, the factory, raw materials, caloric arithmetic.
So the impact now, in 2024, why does this book resonate so strongly?
I think because it pushes back against any temptation to simplify or sentimentalize the Holocaust. It forces you, the reader, the listener, to confront the messy, morally complex, bureaucratic reality of the camps. Suffering didn't automatically make people saints. Survival often involved terrible choices.
Okay, so let's distill that. If we apply DeBertini's clear-eyed analysis, what are the big universal lessons for us today? Well, first, it's a stark reminder that civilization is a fragile veneer. He shows just how quickly the structures we rely on, laws, ethics, empathy, can crumble under extreme pressure, revealing something much more primal underneath. We can't take social order for granted.
That's definitely one. Second, I'd say it's the profound danger of dehumanizing bureaucracy. As DeBertini meticulously documents, the horror didn't start with violence. It started with paperwork, with language that classified and dehumanized people, turning mass murder into an administrative task.
Right. Sanitizing evil through procedure.
Exactly. It's a timeless warning about how systems can enable atrocities by removing individual responsibility and obscuring the human cost.
And the third lesson feels like it comes from his very act of writing the book.
Absolutely. It's the enduring power of witness. For DeBertini, observing, recording, and reporting the truth, no matter how dark or complex, wasn't just his old job. It became a fundamental moral act, an act of resistance against forgetting, against erasure. You know, his work leaves us with a really challenging thought about survival itself. If, as he implies, survival often came down to sheer dumb luck and that kind of intellectual coldness, rather than just virtue or inner strength, what does that say about the moral weight of being a survivor? And how do we, receiving this knowledge decades later, bear the responsibility of understanding those uncomfortable truths he laid bare?
That's a heavy question. Confronting that gray zone, the ambiguity, the systemic nature of it all, that's the challenge DeBertini leaves us with. I strongly encourage everyone listening to seek out Cold Crematorium because, well, in a world always tempted to simplify or forget, remembering the truth and all its difficult complexity really is an act of resistance. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akutra Foundation.